Item one, bigger is better. Item two, a detour to Iowa agriculture. And item the third, how to make some money in the art market. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today the 24th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It's a pretty simple observation of fact to say that a lot of the norms of political behavior in this country aren't norms anymore. Things have just changed. But you start putting money on the line and you get business and economics involved and you realize why norms are the norm. Things like size matters and grow or die, which gets us to the corporate news of the past couple of days. Comcast won its bidding war for the British pay TV service Sky in an auction this weekend, as you might have heard. Today we learned the satellite radio company Sirius XM is going to buy Pandora, the streaming service, for $3.5 billion. Also today, reports that the U.S. fashion brand Michael Kors is all set to take over Italy's Versace for almost $2.5 billion. Because, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, norms are the norms for a reason.
To borrow a line from the musical Sweeney Todd, the history of the world, my sweet, is who gets eaten and who gets to eat. And let's just say there are a lot of hungry companies out there.
Yes, we are in boom times.
Stephen Davidoff Solomon is professor of law at UC Berkeley. There was an all-time record high number of mergers and acquisitions in the first quarter of 2018. They fell sharply in the second quarter, but overall they've been growing since 2009. Solomon says low interest rates have made financing big deals cheaper. Anant Sundaram, professor of finance at the Tuck School, says a few industries have been especially active this year.
In the tech sector in particular, in healthcare, there's been a lot of activity where companies are seeing really big growth opportunities.
Sundaram says companies also feel rich. They have a lot of cash and their stocks are high, so why not just buy other companies? Davidoff Solomon says there's something else at play too.
It's quite clear that in today's economy, it's a winner-take-all economy. We are at a place where if you're not big and cross-border and capable of investing large sums in projects, you're just simply going to be eaten by someone else.
Increasingly, many industries are dominated by a few giants.
The antitrust laws just don't apply to keep them small.
Antitrust laws, after all, prevent two competitors from combining if that negatively affects consumers.
But what we have now is Amazon buying Whole Foods. That is Amazon simply getting bigger, but it's also Amazon entering a field where there are many competitors.
So that's the backdrop. It's unclear whether the pace of mergers and acquisitions can sustain the record it reached in the first quarter of 2018. But the general mood now is eat or get eaten. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The Trump administration proposed a new immigration rule this weekend that it says is intended to promote, quote, self-sufficiency. In practice, the rule would make it harder for low-income immigrants to come to the United States or to get a green card once they're here because it would penalize the use of public benefits, specifically whether those immigrants would need food assistance or Medicaid. The operative phrase here is whether those people would become what is known as a public charge. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains what that phrase has historically meant and what the Trump administration seems to want it to mean.
The public charge doctrine has been part of U.S. immigration law since 1882. Stephen Yale Layer teaches immigration law at Cornell.
It probably was the most common way to exclude people back about 100 years ago.
Yale Layer says in the early 1900s, tens of thousands of would-be immigrants were denied entry because of public charge concerns. Now the rule is interpreted so narrowly and used so rarely, the Department of Homeland Security doesn't even keep track. Why the change? Congress has never actually defined what public charge means.
So it's been left up to rulemaking and agency interpretation. And this new proposed rule would dramatically expand the administration's view of what constitutes a public charge.
Mark Greenberg is a fellow at the Migration Policy Institute. He says the Trump administration's proposed rule
would look at the use of SNAP benefits, food stamps. It would look at Medicaid, at housing assistance.
All to help determine whether someone should be allowed into the country or get a green card once they are here. The administration argues these changes will save taxpayers money and encourage immigrants to be more self-sufficient. But Daniel Griswold at the Mercatus Center says that's unlikely.
this has all the signs of being a backdoor attempt to reduce legal immigration. It's not going to significantly reduce welfare expenses for American taxpayers.
The proposed rule will now go through a 60-day comment period before the Trump administration makes the final decision on who is a public charge. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was interesting. Oil rose as OPEC decided at a meeting this weekend it is not going to bump up its production quotas. The NASDAQ and the S&P pretty much broke even. The Dow hiccuped a bit on the news of the meeting coming later this week between the president and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. Hiccuped just a little bit, though, did the markets. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are, one can say without fear of contradiction, a lot of moving parts in American trade policy right now. And if you think it's tough to keep track as a consumer of trade and tariff news, imagine what it's like if it's your job. With the latest round of tariffs and counter-tariffs between Beijing and Washington having gone into effect today, we got Mike Naig back on the phone. He's the agriculture secretary in Iowa, land of hogs and corn and soybeans and so much more that's on China's hit list. Mr. Secretary, welcome back to the program, sir.
Well, great to be with you, Kai.
So we had you on five-ish or so months ago, just as this whole tariff thing was getting going. What's the lay of the land right now in Iowa? How you feeling?
Things have continued to progress here. Unfortunately, we've not seen resolution to those things that we were concerned about back 5-6 months ago. China and NAFTA continue to be top-of-mind issues for our producers. Overall, really looking at the challenge of profitability in agriculture for our farmers today.
So if I'm a banker in Iowa and some farmer comes in and says, hey, I've got this really great idea to plant a bunch of soybeans, and the banker looks at the headlines and says, really?
Well, they're certainly looking at the broad landscape, but that market absolutely does factor into their ability to secure financing. When you've got the cost of production that exceeds the value of the crop right now, that creates challenges. That's not sustainable for our producers.
Talk to me about NAFTA for a second. We just heard this past Friday from Kevin Hassett, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors at the White House, that the White House is near a deal with Mexico. Forget Canada, but Mexico in that NAFTA thing. Talk to me about that.
Well, we're very encouraged by that progress with Mexico. For Iowa, Canada and Mexico are our number one and number two trading partners. So encouraged that we've seen the progress with Mexico, but we really do need to get Canada to the table and do this thing in a full package.
I'm sure you saw the ad in the Des Moines Register this past weekend from China Daily. Basically, the Chinese government, not basically, the Chinese government flat out blaming President Trump for the current situation that Iowa farmers and folks find themselves in. Your thoughts on that?
The markets are definitely being impacted by Chinese retaliatory tariffs. And I think a lot of folks that I visit with across the state are They're no fans of tariffs, but let's be really clear about something here, and that's that we had trade disruptions and trade barriers with China prior to this series of events. This is a market that we should be playing in a bigger way and have been blocked because of a variety of things. So we think there's a huge upside here for us to be a great supplier to the Chinese in the long run, but we've got to get some of these things right with intellectual property and regulatory programs that work. So we need to see some action.
Action from whom, sir? On what specific issues?
Well, we need to get the Chinese to the negotiating table. The administration needs to negotiate with some urgency. Again, get NAFTA done, but also start playing offense again on trade. Countries that were involved in the TPP, for instance, Japan and others, those are important markets for us as well.
Let's remember that's the Trans-Pacific Partnership that the White House pulled us out of.
That's right. We need to reengage, whether with the TPP directly or with bilateral agreements with those countries. Again, important markets for us, so let's play offense on trade as well.
Mike Naig, he's the Secretary of Agriculture for the great state of Iowa. Mr. Secretary, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks, and good to be with you.
As I was just saying, today is a big day in global trade. And we've been talking to some of the hundreds of people who testified last month about the new round of U.S. tariffs. And we noticed a lot of them said similar things. So here are, in order, Francine Lamorello. She works for the Personal Care Products Council. Naomi Wilson. She works for a group that represents tech companies. And Ann Wilson, whose organization represents companies that make auto parts. Here you go.
My name is Francine Lamorello. I'm the Executive Vice President for Global Strategies at the Personal Care Products Council.
I'm Naomi Wilson, Director for China and Asia at the Information Technology Industry Council.
Ann Wilson, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs for the Motor and Equipment Manufacturers Association.
I think the first thing to point out is that the cosmetic and personal care products industry is very dependent on open markets and the ability to access supplies and inputs from everywhere around the world.
Depends on inputs from around the globe.
Pieces of final products may be put together in China and then shipped back to the U.S., but ultimately they are finalized in the United States.
We think small companies are likely to be hit hardest.
Companies have had to adapt.
We are hurting a lot of people in the United States who depend on that trade. Some of our smaller manufacturers are not hiring now.
We're essentially putting a tax on ourselves.
It's going to lead to higher costs and prices.
Cell phones, flat panel TVs, laptops, etc.
Shampoos, toothpaste, makeup.
It's also going to decrease the choice that many American consumers are going to find when they go to service their vehicle or when they go to repair a vehicle.
Every day we have to check the headlines and really understand what policies by the U.S. or other countries are being put in place that are going to affect our industry.
One of the things that has really troubled our members is a lack of certainty.
Every day we hear different sets of rumors. It seems like the administration takes one tack and then makes an abrupt turn. It's been my job to help them separate truth from fiction and help try to make the administration understand that there are long-term implications for this type of action, and it doesn't resolve our real and problematic issues.
Once again, Francine Lamoriello of the Personal Care Products Council, Naomi Wilson at the Information Technology Industry Council, and Ann Wilson with the Motor and Equipment Manufacturers Association. Moral of the story? Three areas, tech, personal care products, and auto parts, one global economy. Coming up.
Last spring at auction, there were 15 women who broke sales records.
Why you should buy art by women. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. Dow Industrial's off 0.6% today, 181 points, closed at 26,562. NASDAQ added less than 0.1%, basically flat, 6 points up, ended the day at 79.93. S&P 500 gave back 0.3%, 10 points, 29.19. Today's theme, as we said at the top of the broadcast, deals, deals, deals. Nobody was happy about Sirius and Pandora. I'll tell you what, Sirius dialed back 10%. Pandora took a 1% hit. Not much love for the rumored $2 billion Michael Kors Versace mashup either. Investors said arrivederci to Kors shares, knocking the price down 8%. Versace isn't public. Comcast beat out 21st Century Fox in the weekend auction for British broadcaster BSkyB. Comcast shares promptly unloaded 6%, but it appears, actually, you can win for losing. 21st Century Fox added 1.5%. Disney up more than 2%. On expectations, Comcast is going to try to buy its share of BSkyB. Coming up next. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.08%. You're listening to Marketplace. Every day, you make economic decisions that affect your life, including choices that aren't obviously about money. That's why Marketplace covers business and finance from so many different angles in a way that is smart, relatable, and even kind of fun. To keep public service journalism going strong, please go to Marketplace.org today and become a Marketplace investor with a donation in any amount. And we do appreciate your support. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The business and economic word of the day this Monday is market saturation. The specific case in point is Michael Moore's latest documentary, Fahrenheit 11/9, about the rise of Donald Trump. It opened this weekend in more than 1,700 theaters, nearly half of all the theaters in the country, by the way, but brought in just $3 million at the box office, well below expectations. There is an increasingly crowded field of politically themed movies and TV shows and books and podcasts out there because, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports, that's where the money is.
Here's a taste of Fahrenheit 11/9.
How did this happen?
The American dream is dead.
This is vintage Michael Moore, confrontational, in your face. And given the film's unusually wide release, Hollywood clearly and mistakenly thought it was in line for a hit, maybe even another Fahrenheit 9/11. That was Moore's scathing 2004 takedown of the George W. Bush administration and a game changer.
No one expected this Michael Moore documentary to gross $222 million worldwide.
That's Jason Squire, a professor at USC School of Cinematic Arts. He says Fahrenheit 9/11 remains the most successful political documentary in history, and it was made on a budget of just $6 million. Squire says that's one reason.
Documentaries have exploded in the last 10, 15 years.
Only some of those films are about politics, and those that are mostly tilt toward the left. But conservatives are also finding an audience.
Obama has a dream that the sins of colonialism be set right and America be downsized.
That's from the 2012 film Obama's America, based on a book by conservative writer Dinesh D'Souza. The movie is second to Fahrenheit 9/11 as far as profits go. D'Souza's pro-Trump Death of a Nation was released nationwide this summer, but like Moore's latest, it didn't do nearly as well as D'Souza's earlier effort. Some films become political by accident. Take RBG, the story of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Here she is musing about the arguments she made before the court as a young lawyer.
I did see myself as kind of a kindergarten teacher in those days because the judges didn't think sex discrimination existed.
RBG was directed and produced by Julie Cohen and Betsy West. West says they didn't set out to make a political film.
We began the film in early 2015, which was long before the presidential election and really was not something that was on our mind at all.
But by May of this year, when RBG was released, Donald Trump was in office. And
the political landscape, Me Too, Time's Up, all of those events make Ruth Bader Ginsburg's life story that much more interesting to people.
The movie grossed $14 million at the box office and made Ginsburg a kind of cult figure, a big-budget feature based on her life as headed into theaters on Christmas Day. Paul DeGarabedian is a senior media analyst at Comscore, which tracks audience data.
If I'm a producer in today's world, a politically charged documentary or movie or TV show or book is much more interesting and much more financially viable in terms of being able to either turn a profit or draw a large audience than ever before.
Fear, the new book on the Trump administration by journalist Bob Woodward, has sold more than 1 million copies. Books from the late Senator John McCain and former Trump insider Omarosa Manigault Newman are also on the New York Times bestseller list, and some of you may recognize this voice.
I didn't know what to do with myself. And then we had an election.
Yep, that's Candace Bergen, reviving her 1990s role as TV news anchor Murphy Brown. CBS has bet big on the sitcom and its aging baby boomer cast. The show debuts this week. And there's more where all this came from. As they say in Hollywood, you need conflict to tell a good story. And we've got plenty of that. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
We're headed into the fall art auction season, which means a whole bunch of international art fairs and exhibitions and high-profile sales are about to begin. And historian and biographer Mary Gabriel has a tip: buy art done by women. She explained why in the pages of the New York Times today, and also thematically in her new book, which is called Ninth Street Women. It's about a group of five influential and newly relevant modern artists who happen to be women. Mary, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me.
One hates to be too naked about this up front, but the basic gist of this article you've written in the paper and also the book is that not only is women's art undervalued, but now's a really good time to buy women's art because it is undervalued.
It is. It's funny. You know, the point of the book is about the sort of spirituality of art and this wonderful scene, this pure scene before art became a business. But what we inherited from this group, from the abstract expressionists in the 1950s, is the art market, because basically it was born in the mid-1950s, the American art market, for a number of reasons, tax breaks were given to collectors, and the economy was booming, and people didn't know what to do with their money. Huh. And so women are part of that, though historically they've been neglected.
Can I ask a really non-art connoisseur question? It goes like this. Is the art that women do different than the art that men do?
No, it's amazing. Lee Krasner, one of the women I write about, said that this discrimination or this bias against women artists is as old as Judeo-Christianity. And in fact, it is, because the very notion, it's born in the very notion of God, who is a he, you know, the initial creator. And so that's quite a burden for a woman artist. But the women abstract expressionists really broke through that gender barrier and became very famous in their own time. When the art world became an art business, dealers stopped showing women because collectors, once again, because this was the tradition in the history of art, collectors didn't think women's work had as much value. And so that's when you begin to see women really being discriminated against.
What about, though, sort of contemporary-ish artists working today who want like gallery space, right? Are women getting that, or are they getting the exposure?
They are, and it's really heartening to see finally, because this has been a fight that's been going on for decades. What's happened is that galleries, for a number of reasons, one, because of the kind of renewed interest in women's rights in general in society, another, because there's been activist feminist artists who've been really working for many, many years to try to draw attention to women artists. And thirdly, once again, the economics of it. Dealers are awakening to the idea that women artists are of value and of interest to collectors. And so now 30% of a gallery's stable might be women artists. Hmm. Now, to put that in perspective, in the United States, 51% of the professional artists are women. So they're not represented in galleries at the rate they are in existence. But but we're getting there.
So give me your guess for the upcoming, I guess it's a fall auction season, right? Are we going to see women artists getting the dollar amounts that maybe they haven't in the past?
Oh, I think definitely. You know, whether it's the dollar amount they deserve just yet, I don't know. But I think definitely they'll be getting the attention, because it's really a fantastic time to be a collector and to be able to discover these women who, you know, might have painted 70 years ago, but their work is completely new because it's been so neglected. And so you take an artist like Joan Mitchell, who was really one of the strongest painters to emerge out of the abstract expressionist period, but she was also very timid, and she didn't want to become part of the art market and the whole hustle of trying to sell. And so she moved to France and worked on her own in a property where Claude Monet had once lived, and painted beautiful, you know, masterpieces. And now collectors are discovering her, and she's actually broken a record last spring at auction. There were 15 women who broke sales records, because collectors are discovering that there's this entire market of incredibly talented people.
Mary Gabriel, her book on the subject at hand is called Ninth Street Women. Mary, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, listener email edition from a hockey parent in Northern California, quote, "My 9-year-old son and I drive to hockey practice twice a week and listen to Marketplace on the drive. Lately, we've been hearing about and learning about the upcoming tariffs on Chinese-made goods. Today," she writes, "while shopping for Hot Wheels cars, my son says, 'Mom, I need to buy more Hot Wheels before the Chinese tariffs are implemented. I want to still be able to afford them. End of quote. He spends his own money on them, apparently. 97 cents apiece. All right, we're going. Dow off 0.6% today, 181 points. NASDAQ added less than 0.1%. We'll call that flat. S&P 500 gave back 0.3% today. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Phoebe Unterman. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Ash is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.